I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with the historian Sven Beckert, one of the young point men in a fascinating scholarly project to rethink capitalism, which is to say our modern machine of investment, invention, growth, and distribution of the benefits. A very big idea under stress, to put it mildly, these days. But the project we associate with you, Sven Beckert, is not the dismal science of numbers about the economy today. It's the long profile over time in the spirit of, let's look at the record, as Harry Truman used to say. You're compiling, in effect, a biography of capitalism. And in this incredibly absorbing book, Empire of Cotton, you found the life story in the adventures of one commodity moving back and forth in production, distribution, all around the world over something like 250 years. And it's a story that has everything in it, including war and peace. I mean, it's a Tolstoyan sort of epic, and with a certain mystery in the end about what drives this incredibly productive and destructive virus. Can you tell it as a kind of biography of this thing, cotton?
Yes, I think you can tell the biography of a thing. And cotton is particularly a good commodity to look at to understand the dramatic changes that the global economy went through, because for two reasons. For one, because cotton was the most important human manufacturing industry in the 900 years between approximately 1000 of the Common Era and 1900. That is, it was already a very, very important manufacturing industry before the Industrial Revolution. And then second, cotton is a good commodity to look at to understand the global economy, because it becomes the core industry of the first Industrial Revolution, when our modern industrial world comes into being, when our modern industrial world is being born. It is born in the cotton textile industry. And the cotton textiles and cotton manufacturing stay at the center of the global industrial economy until the early years of the 20th century. And thus, to tell the story of cotton is a way to tell the story of global capitalism.
It's old, as you say, but I learned from you that it's also new, cotton, and it's late getting to Europe. Europeans used wool and linen much more than cotton before the middle of the 18th century. It has a kind of Asian parentage, and it arrives, obviously, at an opportune moment when Britain is ready to seize the possibilities.
Right. In a way, the story of cotton as it unfolds is very, very surprising, because, as you said, the cotton industry is very ancient. I mean, humans have manufactured cotton textiles for approximately 5,000 years. And for many millennia, its center was in East Africa, in Latin America, and especially in South Asia. But Europe was really not very much part of this very important industry for the first 4,000 years or
and
so
why?
Of its history.
Why not?
Because cotton doesn't grow in Europe, so Europeans had no experience with the plant itself. And because the trade was very limited, the spatial extent of trade was very, very limited. And thus, Europeans encountered cotton fabrics probably for the first time about 2,000 years ago when they began trading with South Asia. But Europe only came to the manufacturing of cotton textiles in the 12th century, when for the first time, northern Italian manufacturers imported raw cotton via the port of Venice from the Middle East. And it is in the 12th century that a very, very small European cotton manufacturing industry began to emerge. But that industry was dependent on raw materials that came from the Eastern Mediterranean. And it was dependent on technology that had been imported, especially from South Asia, but also from China, such as the spinning wheel, which first comes to Europe as an invention as part of the cotton industry. And it is an invention that comes out of China and South Asia and moves via the Arab world then to Europe. But cotton remains very, very marginal to the European economy. And Europe is very, very marginal to the global cotton industry until the 18th century. And in the 18th century, some things have dramatically changed now that make Europe much, much more important to the global cotton industry. And so for one, since the late 15th century, but especially in the 16th and 17th century, the imperial expansion of Europe has suddenly now familiarized Europeans with South Asian textile fabrics, cotton fabrics, to a much, much greater extent than was ever the case before. At the same time, Europeans now captured markets in parts of the world that they had not controlled before. So, for example, on the west coast of Africa, and then also in the Americas. And then also Europeans suddenly came to control their own sources of raw cotton. And that was principally in the plantation economies in the Caribbean, and then in Brazil, and eventually in North America. And so now Europe was inserted into the global networks of this industry in a radically different way from how they had participated in this industry in its first couple of thousands of years. And this came before any new machines were invented. So Europe became important to the global cotton industry before Europeans invented any new machines of manufacturing cotton textiles.
In terms of the biography I'm thinking about, it becomes a story of how this kind of Asian ingenue comes to England and then goes global. But also, it's the most interesting history of the British Empire that I've ever read, or recently anyway. And underlying it, the mystery of how England, offshore there in Europe, doesn't grow cotton farmers, captures both the labor force and the machinery, builds Liverpool, of course, but becomes the center of the world around this commodity. They're deeply in on the distribution of slave labor from Africa to the Caribbean and elsewhere, and then they take over the infant South Asian industries and rule the world on this discovery, on this moment.
Right. So already in the 18th century, as I mentioned before, Britain and also to some extent France had become important to the global networks of the cotton industry. They imported cotton textiles from South Asia. They sold these textiles in Europe itself, but they also sold them in places like West Africa and the Caribbean. And they also increasingly became involved in the growing of cotton in the Americas. So in some ways, they had already become a center of the global cotton industry, but in one way, they were not particularly important to this industry, and that was in the realm of production. Most cotton textile production still occurred, especially in South Asia, but also to some extent in China. And what happened then in the 18th century, Europeans knew about all of these markets. They had discovered new sources of raw cotton. They had captured the land in the Americas on which this cotton could be grown. They had captured the labor that would do the growing of this cotton. And it is at this point that Europeans and mostly people in England invent also new ways of manufacturing cotton textiles, first in the spinning of the thread and later also in the weaving. And that's the moment when these new machines come about and increase the productivity in cotton spinning and weaving really quite drastically. The productivity increases in spinning alone up approximately by a factor of 370. So it's a radical increase in human productivity. But my argument is that the incentive to doing so is a result of the previous capturing of these global cotton networks through European empires and through European merchants and entrepreneurs and others.
There's an incredible global facility of moving all this technology and the production and the distribution around. It happens slow enough so you don't see, but in certain ways, I understood in your book the sort of the Indian view that the British Empire didn't bring industry and produce. It first destroyed the industry that India had already developed. And then similarly, there are other ways, I mean, it's part of the local legend in Boston, that one of the early Lowells, of the folk who speak only to the Cabots and Cabots only to God, etc., fundamentally stole, with a photographic memory, stole the idea of the machinery in England that became the basis of the first industrial revolution in this country and one of the great production centers of cotton and wool just up the road. There's a speed in transferring the magic of this game everywhere, at every point.
Right, and that happens then very rapidly. So if you write the biography of a thing, the biography of cotton and the industry related to cotton, then it allows you to look at this kind of global spread of particular technologies and particular ideas. And much of the early innovations in cotton manufacturing technology and the printing of cotton textiles, as you mentioned, come from South Asia. And it's Europeans who send individuals and commissions to South Asia to watch Indian artisans to manufacture cotton textiles, to learn how to do this. And they bring that technology to Europe. And eventually, Europeans by the 18th century are more or less able to master these skills and these techniques. But then comes the radical reinvention of how things are being produced in the cotton textile industry, beginning in the 1760s in Great Britain, but then greatly accelerating in the 1780s. And And so suddenly there's this new fact in the world. There's this new way of manufacturing cotton yarn that is radically more productive than anything that had ever existed before.
And who invented it?
It's a group of inventors like Richard Arkwright. These are not theoretical scientists. These are practical men.
Practical Scotsmen.
They are artisans. They work in some workshop and they see the promise of this new thing, cotton. And they are playing around with the tools that they have, and they invent new ways of manufacturing that really constitute, I think, not only an important moment in the history of the global cotton industry, but really a very significant moment in the history of the world at large, because it suddenly opens up this possibility of a world that becomes ever more productive, a world in which we live to this day. And this really originates in the cotton industry in England in the 1760s and 1780s and thereafter. But from there, it then spreads into other regions of the world. And it spreads first to Northwestern Europe. And then eventually, as you mentioned, it spreads to the United States. And indeed, it spreads through something like, you know, people traveling to England, watching these new machines at work, and then committing the design of these machines to memory and bringing them to other parts of the world. It also spreads through the migration of English artisans who come to open textile factories in many different parts of the world, including the United States. The British state tries to prevent that. There are laws that disallow the exportation of these machines. There are laws that disallow these artisans to migrate. But, you know, this is basically a hopeless task, and the technology spreads very, very rapidly. But of course, it only spreads to some areas of the world. And it's a very interesting question of why it spreads, for example, to the United States and to Northwestern Europe, but why it does not spread until much later to places like China or Egypt or
Brazil.
Well,
by now, of course, it's found its way back.
Right.
Back home. Of course, it's a central thread of your story that capitalism and cotton grew and thrived hand in hand with slavery, especially and specifically in the United States. At what point does that become an integral piece of the growth here?
It is really important to remember that this industry is very, very old. Humans have manufactured cotton textiles for a very long time. But the monocultural production of cotton on plantations is something that's of relatively recent vintage. This is something that really only emerged in the 18th century. And it's only emerging at a moment when Europeans become important to the global cotton industry. So with the expansion of that industry in Europe in the 18th century, European manufacturers faced one big problem, namely that they lived in a part of the world in which no cotton could be grown. And they were thus trying to purchase raw cotton from other parts of the world. And there had been a long history of doing that since the 12th century, of purchasing that cotton first from the Eastern Mediterranean, mostly from Western Anatolia. But then there was also some cotton coming into Europe from West Africa and from India. But the quantities of that cotton were quite limited. And European merchants failed to secure significantly more cotton from these parts of the world, all parts of the world in which cotton was grown by peasant labor, not by slave labor. And so it was in the middle of the 18th century that European merchants discovered that cotton could be grown on plantations using slave labor. And this model of how to procure cotton really began to become important by the 1750s. And then with the Industrial Revolution of the 1780s, the demand for cotton increased drastically. And therefore, the pressure to secure more of this cotton on the slave plantations of the Americas increased as well. And from that point on until the end of the American Civil War, until 1865, slavery expands in lockstep with the expansion of the European and the United States cotton textile industry.
There's a moment in your book that seems to me to say it all. By this time, in the middle of the 19th century, this whole machine built on, of course, captured land, captured labor, is humming. The Mississippi Delta, you write, 1859, 60,000 slaves producing 66 million pounds of cotton, 10 times the productivity of the French machine in the Caribbean. Here's the sentence, which I think sums up so much. For the Delta to become the chief grower of the industrial world's most important commodity, a kind of Saudi Arabia of the early 19th century, its land had to be taken from its original inhabitants, and its labor, capital, knowledge, and state power had to be mobilized. So we've got public, private, huge riches, miserable bondage, all in one state. steaming kettle.
Right. So cotton comes to the United States by the 1790s. At least a significant cotton production for export comes to the United States in the 1790s. And it's a very good question to ask of why it comes to the United States. Because before the 1790s, the United States really did not produce, or North America did not produce very much cotton for global markets. But it was in the 1780s and 1790s that certain things globally changed, but also changed within North America that made that outcome much more likely. For one, the demand for cotton in the European industry increased very radically. At the same time, the most important source for raw cotton, namely the French colony of Saint-Domingue, experiences a revolution, and therefore the production of cotton there for European markets decreases radically. And at the same time, the United States, the new United States, now had a federal government committed to a kind of continental expansion. Mm. It had plentiful labor available because the tobacco agriculture of the Upper South went into decline after the American Revolution. So there were many enslaved workers in the Upper South that could be used to grow cotton. And at the same time, there was a lot of land available, and the federal government was committed to removing native populations from that land. And so there was suddenly the United States, which had basically unlimited supplies of land that could grow cotton, and at the same time, huge supplies of slave labor that could be deployed to work up this land and to plant cotton and to harvest that cotton, and the government committed to this particular project. So I think it was the combination of state power, but then availability of slave labor and the availability of land that then encouraged vast investments by European bankers and by European merchants into the growing of cotton in the United States. And it didn't take very long. By the 1820s already, cotton grown by slaves in the United States dominated global markets.
One of the things that made me scratch my head, Sven Beckert, was the puzzle of the Civil War and the war over slavery, abolitionism, eventually a horrific war in this country. In your telling, the New England establishment in textiles, but also in sea trade, including the slave trade, was hand in glove with production of cotton yarn itself. Why did we go to war over it?
If you look at the biography of this thing, if you look at the history of cotton, then I think it's first important to see that the American Civil War is not just an event that is of huge consequence to the history of the United States, but it's also an event that is of huge consequence to the history of the wider world, especially to global capitalism, because at this moment it was that the central raw material of the industrial world suddenly disappeared from global markets. And one of the outcomes of this war was that the enslaved cotton growers of the American South gained their freedom. And therefore, one of the central pillars of the global economy, as it had evolved in the 80 years before the American Civil War, suddenly became very shaky. The war itself, first it's the South that secedes from the Union. And why does the South secede from the Union? The South has built this fabulously productive, fabulously wealthy system of production, much of it cotton for world markets, that rests on slave labor, that rests on the territorial expansion of that slave labor complex ever further into the American West. And it rests on a system of trade that allows for the exportation of agricultural commodities and the low tariff importation of other things into the United States. The production of cotton by slave labor was embedded within a particular political system.
Yeah.
And this political system was essential for the continuation of this particular way of producing cotton for world markets: slavery, low tariffs, and continental expansion. But at the same time, the United States as a whole began to change in the 1830s, 1840s, and thereafter. There was suddenly, in places like New England, outside of Boston, there were suddenly people coming who would make profit in different ways. They would invest in manufacturing. They would be suddenly interested in attracting immigrants to the United States. They were interested in protectionism, to protect their own industries. They were interested in the expansion of free labor agriculture into the American West. So they had very, very different interests, political interests, from the slaveholders of the American South. And they became also ever more powerful because they became, in terms of population and political power, they became more significant to the Union as a whole. And that really scared the planters of the American South, who eventually decided that what they provide to the global economy, namely raw cotton, is so important that they would be able to create their own nation state independent of the states of the American North and hope that the rest of the world is going to go along because the rest of the world is so dependent on the cotton that came out of their slave plantations. And this was, of course, a drastic miscalculation.
Back to the biography of cotton. I mean, out of its Asian accent to begin with, and gone to Europe and gone global, it's had a brutal midlife crisis, so to speak, in the American Civil War. How does cotton keep going post-slavery? And can it?
In the wake of the American Civil War, even during the Civil War, there were many observers who believed that the global cotton industry could not thrive without slave labor. They might have disapproved of the institution of slavery. They might have thought that slavery was a really terrible thing. But they believed that slavery was so integral, so important to global capitalism, that the global cotton industry would be weakened or even collapse without the resort to slave labor. And they were dramatically wrong. It turned out that it was possible by the 1860s and by the 1870s to produce cotton for world markets without enslaving the workers who grew that cotton. And this already happened during the American Civil War itself, when European imperial powers, especially in India, but also in Brazil and in Egypt, successfully tried to increase cotton production for export in these parts of the world, a project that early in the 19th century had failed, but now succeeded. And it eventually also succeeded in the American South, where freed slaves returned to cotton production, not entirely voluntarily, but they returned to cotton production, but they worked now as sharecroppers or tenant farmers. And by the end of the 19th century, they produced a very significantly larger amount of cotton than was ever produced during slavery times, which shows that capitalism had now evolved in a way that allowed it to produce agricultural commodities such as cotton for world markets without enslaving its workers.
Meantime, there are endless thousands, hundreds of thousands of wage slaves in cotton production in Bangladesh to this day. But what's the direction of things overall in the humanity of underlying cotton?
Right. So I think that's a really important question. And there is, kind of an easy way to think about this. And this is to say that if you look at the global cotton industry today, there's clearly still an enormous degree of misery. There's an enormous degree of exploitation. There's even an enormous degree of violence and coercion still in the global cotton industry today. But
Where in particular should we know more about the cruelty of it?
I mean, for example, if you think about Uzbekistan as a very important presence on global cotton markets today. And among other things, the cotton harvest is still done by children to a large degree who are practically forced to harvest that cotton. If you think about the working conditions and wages in the textile factories of Bangladesh, I mean, these are really terrible working conditions, and often they are kind of absurdly dangerous. I mean, they're so dangerous that it seems hard to believe that anybody would create such conditions. But things are really quite terrible. There are many cotton growers in West Africa who live on less than $1 a day. So there is still an enormous degree of exploitation, misery, and coercion in that industry. But I think it is also important to see that plantation slavery of the kind that had been very much at the center of this industry for its first 80 years, that this plantation slavery does not exist anymore. And thus, there is a significant change in the way coercion and violence and exploitation is exerted in the world today from how it was exerted 160 years ago. And I want to insist on the importance of that change.
Spell it out, please.
Slavery is in some ways, a kind of unique form of of exploitation, because it gives literally total control of the labor to the owner of this worker. And it's also unique in that the status of slave is inherited by the children. So this is a truly hopeless situation out of which it is very, very difficult to escape, and out of which it is also very difficult for their children to escape. But there is something very different about the kinds of exploitation that we can observe today. And I think it is really important to insist on the significance of emancipation. I think it's also important to insist on the significance of emancipation in one other way, and that is, you know, in 1860, the industrial world depended on this raw material. This raw material was produced by slaves. Thus, the industrial world depended on the institution of slavery. Very, very powerful interests in the world of the 1850s and thereafter were dependent on slavery. And the more impressive it is that there were people who were willing to fight against this extremely powerful institution. And it's also important to remember that the enslaved cotton workers of the American South, once the opportunity arose to gain their freedom, they participated in this fight to destroy the institution of slavery.
What does that mean today, as we hear in various slogans, but that it was slave labor that picked the cotton, built the capital, that built our capitalism? I mean, how do we unpack that? How do we absorb it humanly?
You know, I think the global story of cotton is a story of great change. It's a story of great tragedy, it's a story of great exploitation, but it's also a story of great courage. Plantation slavery is not a major part of the global economy today, and in some ways we overcame that particular form of exploitation. But I think what we need to remember is that the world in which we live in today was partly created by this tremendous degree of exploitation on slave plantations. And in some ways, the world we live in today has been created by the labor of people who have been enslaved for many, many generations. It has been created by taking the land of America's native peoples. And thus, in some ways, that legacy is still with us.
What should we be thinking about this miracle fabric and all the kind of misery that's been associated with it? You're wearing a cotton shirt, so am I. What do we think about?
Ideally, what I would like us to be able to think about is where this cotton shirt comes from and how it came into being and what kind of history unfolded to make it possible for us to acquire this cotton shirt, often at very inexpensive prices. And we often don't. We live, you know, our daily lives in some ways in a particular place, and we consider the people around us, but we often don't know or we don't consider what we do at a particular moment in a particular place also involves people who are very much unlike us and who are very much very far away from us. And I think a historical perspective on the history of this material, on this history of this fabric, cotton, shows immediately how deeply embedded and how much we are implicated in things that happen in very different parts of the world and in places that are very far removed from where we live. And ideally, I would like us to continue to see that we continue to be part of this very deeply interconnected world in which we are then also implicated.
You remind me, I was in a shop in Singapore one time. It was called British Raj, and it must have been a chain, but their slogan was British Raj, a time of exploitation, racism, and really neat outfits. And I think I bought a shirt there.
Right, right. At least they admitted to the exploitation.
Meantime, there's this other biography taking shape throughout your book of capitalism itself as a character. It's incredibly clever. It's inventive. It's energetic to an extreme. It's resourceful, opportunistic. It can be incredibly predatory. It's instinctively global in its reach and its ambition, and it keeps on going. What in the world drives it, and where are we in the history of that character, too?
You know, I think one thing that the history of capitalism certainly teaches you is that anything that might seem stable or permanent is probably neither stable nor permanent. The history of capitalism is a history of often very sudden and certainly very constant and sometimes revolutionary change. And the word of capitalism is, you know, we need to be able to think about capitalism in two very different ways, but we need to think about it at the same time. For one, the word of capitalism is a word of radically increased productivity. It's a word in which the living standards of many people in the world have radically improved over the past 300 years. It is, in some ways, a word in which people have gained new freedoms and new opportunities. But at the same time, as I think this book shows quite well, capitalism also has a very dark history. It's a history of a tremendous violence and coercion. It's a story of terrible exploitation. Mm-hmm. It's a story also of environmental devastation.
And we barely spoke about that, but it's important.
And yeah, you know, when we think about capitalism, we need to be able to think about both of these things at the same time.
You've introduced two characters into my head that I think will be sort of dancing around as long as I live. It's an amazing story for which we're completely grateful. But before we're done, I just wanted you to outline a little bit of your project going forward and the history of how you got here. You're a young man with a German accent at the premier American university, and you've got a following, not only in the reading world, but in the scholarly world. Where is this exploration going?
I really believe that understanding the history of capitalism is essential for us to be able to understand the world in which we live today. And for a long time, many historians have not spent much effort in trying to understand the history of capitalism or the history of economic change more broadly. And I think we need to put this more centrally into our considerations about the human past. What I think I learned through this project is that it's not enough to write a history that is just about a particular place, about a particular region or a particular nation. We need to understand that all histories are in some ways interconnected. And in the end, there is just one human history. We're all in this together. We are all on planet Earth. And in order to understand any part of our histories, we need to also embed it within an account of the whole. And so I think what I'm going to do in the future is I will, you know, certainly want to continue writing a history that is global in aspiration, if not necessarily in scope. I do believe that we need to continues to think very hard about the history of capitalism, because I think in some ways this is going to help us understand our contemporary dilemmas. And I also feel that we as people very privileged to be at universities, to be able to think about these matters, that we have a responsibility to speaking to broader audiences and to speak to the issues that matter to all of our lives today, both the issue of the kind of increasing global interconnectedness of all of our lives and the issue of economic change are certainly very, very important to everyone's life today.
Sven Beckert, it's such a challenging agenda, but we want to follow you as best we can. We're hugely grateful for Empire of Cotton and for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
I'm Christopher Lydon. You can hear more conversations on arts, ideas, and politics at radioopensource.org.